Okay, let's give a warm Tulare County welcome for our warm-up speaker, Kurt.
Hi, everybody. My name is Kirk, and I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is November 4, 2011, and, you know, I like to think of 2011 as being probably the worst year of my life, but, you know, the flip side of that is November 4, 2011 was the best day of my life, and the reason I say that is that that day started my new and improved life. You know, I go to a meeting where we go around and we go around the room and we give our sobriety dates. And for me, you know, personally, that's the most important day of my life. My whole family is a bunch of, you know, they're all normies, and you know, I'm the only one in the family that got afflicted with this disease, and I don't. My birthday, my belly button birthday, chronological birthday, and my sobriety birthday are a month apart. My family and my friends and stuff always make a big deal out of the chronological belly button birthday. And for me, that, you know, I don't put a lot of credence into that date. You know, that date for me is just, you know, all I know is, you know, 9 months prior to me being conceived, my parents went on a cruise and certain things happened. That's all I know about that date. Is that's the only meaning to that date for me. But, you know, November 4, 2011 is when everything changed for me. That was when I like to refer to it as a new and improved life. And I like to welcome Beth to you know, that new and improved life. As much as my ego and Michelle's ego think that we're the most important person in the room tonight, you actually are the most important person in the room tonight. And, you know, my drinking started out, I never had that luxury of being able to control and enjoy my drinking like it talks about in the big book. The first time I drank was that, right out of the gates, it was that pitiful and incomprehensible, demoralizing situation. I drank too much. I blacked out. I passed out. Well, I blacked out. I threw up in my mom's purse in the back seat of her car in the midst of denying that I was drunk, and then I passed out, you know. And from that point forward, I never was able to hit that optimum buzz that we always strive for. You know, it was always too much. And overshooting the mark every time, you know, always thinking it's somebody else's fault. Just briefly, you know, 3 DUIs measuring 0.26, 0.28, and 0.30. Never my fault. Always wrong place at the wrong time. And, you know, and couple outpatient rehabs, couple inpatient rehabs, and, you know, the biggest part of my story and the biggest problem or obstacle I had in trying to get sober is that denial. You know, for many years I was coming into these rooms and I was in the midst of that denial. It was preventing any sort of effective recovery for me. I was coming in on a court card, you know, due to those DUIs that were caused by the cops not remaining in the donut stores where they belong. And so, you know, I was sentenced to come to these rooms and be in a court card, and, you know, just never willing, never getting to that point to where, you know, the step before the steps is, you know, where you fully concede, where you surrender to your, you know, your innermost self, that you're truly an alcoholic. There can't be any more of these lingering notions. So I was coming into these rooms and just would not surrender, would not give up. And all I was doing was coming in and warming a chair for an hour. And I'd come in when the meeting would start. I would sit there and not pay attention and you know, do the minimum that I had to do, and that wasn't enough. And I just kept doing that, and I just kept relapsing over and over and over. And I would say, God, what is wrong? You know, why do I keep relapsing? Why can't I just stay sober? And you know, the part in the chapter 5, you know, is it that I'm constitutionally incapable of being honest with myself, or was I maladjusted to life? You know, which one of these things was it? And the bottom line for me was that I was just not into action. All I was doing was coming in and warming a chair for an hour. And, you know, we all hear these analogies and these things about, you know, if you leave out certain parts of the ingredients, your, you know, baking analogies, if you try to bake a cake and you leave out the flour, the sugar, or whatever, you know, your cake's going to be all fucked up. And that's what happened to me. My program was all fucked up because I was leaving out the essential, you know, ingredients. I want to thank Michelle for asking me to do this at 7:50 p.m. tonight. You know, we're sitting there talking about crawdaddies and menus, and next thing I know, she says, "Oh, hey, blank," and there's a nickname that Sue Ellen has coined that I won't say at a group level, but she said, "Hey, blank, you want to be my warm-up speaker tonight at 7:50? And I was like trying to weasel my way out of it. "Hey, I just spoke there in January. I'm good." "No, I'm not good. You're up." So anyways, I just for many years, you know, I would just ask myself, why can't I stay? You know, why do I just keep being a chronic, repeat, relapsing newcomer? And, you know, it was made clear to me, one of the tools that I was given to do by an old timer, you know, I don't know, we come into this program, we're kind of like a blank slate. We don't know these tools, at least for me, in my opinion. All I knew was put the plug in the jug and that was enough. But, you know, I put the plug in the jug and I still was encountering all the same problems. Problems at work, problems with family, problems in everyday life. And, you know, what I found and what I learned was that, you know, there's more to this program than just putting the plug in the jug. That that's just a starting point for me. You know, once I had to put the plug in the jug, there was more action that needed to be done. And I don't know, I just... It's since November 4, 2011, I finally surrendered at that point. And, you know, my last drunk, I had to... It's hard to describe my last drunk. I lost track of how many days it lasted. It was anywhere from like 8 days to 12 days. But I got to the point to where I was isolating in my apartment for the last... hopelessly unemployable. You know, I got to the point where I became like a frugal, cheap drunk, and I was sitting there drinking natural light beers in my apartment, watching ESPN in my recliner, and could not deal with life or people or do anything outside of my apartment, just totally isolating, hopelessly drinking myself into the gates of insanity or death. And, you know, I thank God for that family intervention that happened on November 10th. And I detoxed for a few days. And I had a kind of an on-again, off-again sponsor at the time in Fresno. And he never gave up on me. And he happened to be the director of CAP. It's a rehab, inpatient rehab in West Fresno. And, you know, he's the one that told me, you know what, you need to change everything. This is more than just stopping drinking and changing some of your friendships. You need to change everything about your life. And that's where I got my start. I went into that inpatient rehab, and I fully surrendered. I had done the outpatients, but you know, I was such a hot mess that outpatients were not, they weren't enough for me. I would drink in between sessions and in between meetings. I mean, that's what kind of program is that? So I had to be in some sort of a lockdown facility. So I went in there for 90 days into the inpatient rehab at CAP, and you know, that's what it took. That was my bottom. It's a low bottom inpatient rehab in West Fresno. And I just had to surrender to all these delusional thoughts that I'm terminally unique, different than, got this, you know, grandiose college degree and shit. I'm nothing but a drunk. And I just had to recognize that, embrace that, and surrender to that. And, you know, now I just, that's all I am now. It's just, you know, a drunk trying to make it through the day and do the right thing and help another person. So that's all I got. Thank you. Thank you, Seth.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, if you take your seats, I really appreciate it.
Okay, let's give a warm Tulare County welcome for our featured speaker, Michelle.
Thank you. My name is Michelle, and I'm a grateful recovered alcoholic. My sobriety date is December 1st, 2006, and my home group is Fresno Fellowship in Fresno. I want to welcome the newcomer, Beth. I'm really glad you're here. And anybody else that's fairly new. What I'd like to say is that anything that I share is just my experience. And what has happened with me in my life in AA. And I'd like to share a little bit about what it was like, and then what happened, and what it's like now. And so, I started drinking at a really young age. I was 12 when I started drinking. I moved from Arizona to Fresno when I was 12. And when I moved here, I still played with dolls. And all the girls that I was meeting when I moved out here were already like partying and like getting interested in guys. And it really interested me, and I felt really awkward because I thought they were all cool, these California girls, and you know, I'm still playing with dolls, and I felt like a geek. So I started getting mixed in with this crowd that was pretty, you know, fun and a little wild and crazy. And you know, I'm the only alcoholic or drug addict in my family. I have no other family members that are alcoholic. And so I really, to me, an alcoholic was the bum that was, you know, laying in the gutter with the brown paper bag, with, you know, the scruffy and dirty, and or the old lady that's pushing the grocery cart around with the puppy dog in it. And, you know, that to me was an alcoholic. So I knew nothing about alcoholism. And I kind of tend to think that, like, from the first day of my drinking, I was alcoholic. I didn't just drink beer. I started immediately drinking hard liquor. We would play Buzz. I don't know if any of you know what Buzz is, but it's a game where you count from one till whenever. And anything that's related to 7, whether it's 7, 14, 27, anything related to 7, when the number comes to you, you say Buzz. And if you miss, if you don't say Buzz, then you have to chug. And we always played with hard liquor. So I would, of course, always, like, skip it on purpose. So I chug. And it was just that way from the very beginning. My girlfriend and I, her parents were realtors, and they loved to entertain. So they had hard liquor in their cabinets. In the backyard, they had a swimming pool. They had a refrigerator back under their covered patio, and they would have casks of wine in there. And, you know, we would go out there and, like, get under the casks of wine. And we would mix. We would go in the kitchen, and we would mix rum and vodka and tequila, and we would mix it with punch or soda. But it would be, like, four or five different hard liquors. And we'd put them in big old tumblers. We lived near Fashion Fair. And we would just walk down the street drinking and go to Fashion Fair and hang out and laugh. And we would just people watch and just, I mean, that's what we did just from the get-go. And that was just my life from the very beginning. And it wasn't just, you know, like parties. It was just because. It was on Saturday. It was on Sunday. Then as I got a little older, I met my ex-husband. We've been divorced about 20 years now. We had a beautiful daughter together. She's 22 now. When he and I got together, it was the same thing. He won't admit he's alcoholic. I'm not one to say that he is, but I kind of have an inkling that he is. And he still drinks to this day. I believe that alcohol played a huge part in our divorce. Our relationship was very volatile. I was 15, he was 22 when we met, and my dad was, like, livid over the whole relationship. You know, like, forbid me to see him, but I was, I'm German and I'm very stubborn, and so, you know, I would hide it from him. I would go out with him and hide it, and then, you know, my mom, you know, got to know my ex-husband pretty well, and she really liked him, so she kind of condoned the relationship. And so we drank. That's all we did, constantly. It was just drinking. And every time we went somewhere, there was an ice chest in the car. As a matter of fact, my first DUI, I was listening to Kurt at, like, what do you say, 0.30, and my first one was a 0.36. And I remember everything. We were over in Monterey, and he was so drunk he couldn't drive. So I ended up getting behind the wheel. And I must have been, worse than what I thought. And next thing I know, you know, we're on Lighthouse, and we're heading home, and all of a sudden these lights go on behind me. So he pulled us over, and he was passed out. So I went through the sobriety test, and I did pretty good. I mean, I did pretty well on the sobriety test. But when it came to them testing me, when I blew, I remember the officer going, like, hitting the thing, like, what? He couldn't believe it was a 0.36. He goes, will you blow for me again? And so, and I mean, I'm walking and I'm talking, and it was just, that was my tolerance to alcohol. And so that was my first DUI. When I went to court over that, and I was making excuses, you know how we justify, and you know, I was telling the judge, but and she goes, ma'am, she said, I don't want to hear it. You should have been dead, let alone passed out in bed at home. So with that, I got my case transferred over. I lived in Madera at the time, so they transferred it from Monterey County over to Madera, and I got, like, 80 hours of community service, and I was court ordered to only 8 AA meetings, and I only got 80 hours of community service, which, like, people, when I told them that, they were surprised that that's all I got for the severity of my, you know, BAL. So I ended up going to about 6 AA meetings. The other, like, 2 of them, I left my house, so my ex-husband thought that I went, and I forged my card. And it wasn't that, you know, I didn't think I wasn't alcoholic. It wasn't that I thought I was better than you, or I didn't like them. I was afraid of you. because I felt like I was so less than. You know, I sat there at my first meeting and I bawled, you know, and I could see a couple people laughing, and I didn't get that at first. I didn't get why they were laughing, and it wasn't because I know they were like making fun of me or something. It was that they had been through the same thing that I had been through, and they could probably see themselves in me. But for me, sitting there, when I shared, it was like all about the fine, you know, what I was having to go through. Oh, poor me. It was the pity party. And but after that first meeting, I remember how many people walked up to me and the hugs and, you know what, it's going to get better. I promise you it will get better. You know, we're here for you. Here's phone numbers. Keep coming back. And it was like, I felt awkward. You know, I just didn't feel like I didn't fit in. And then I couldn't also wait to get back into my car because I had a bottle under the seat of my car and I wanted to drink, you know. And then even though my ex-husband drank, at that point, I drank a hell of a lot more than he did. You know, I mean, it became to the point where I was literally a closet drinker. I would take a bottle and hide it in a coat pocket in the closet. And when we were watching TV, I would get up and act like I had to go to the bathroom, and I would go back into the bedroom and I'd go into my closet and I would drink. And there was one time where he must have been in the back of the house, and he came walking out and I was in the kitchen, and I loved whiskey. That was my drink. I loved Canadian whiskey, VO, Seagram 7. And I was in the kitchen and I actually had the big gallon of whiskey up. And he went, "Will you just do what I thought you were doing?" Like, he had to take a double take. And I was like, I said it back on, like, "No," act like I was just pouring glass, you know, but I was trying to chug as much as I could before he got out there. And it was just getting so bad. And I would not admit I had a problem. You know, I mean, I knew I did, but I couldn't admit it to myself. Deep down inside, I knew I had a problem. So it just kept getting worse. And he and I ended up getting a divorce. I got full custody of my daughter at the time, she was 4. And I lost one job, then I lost another job. And these employers were really nice. I ended up owing amends to 2 of my employers because, you know, they put their trust in me. They gave me jobs, and I drank. I drank on the job. I would go into the bathroom. I would go to lunch and drink and come back. And when they let me go, it was like, well, you're just making too many errors, you know. And I knew. I knew they knew I was drinking. I knew they could smell it. That's when I learned that whiskey smelled really bad and that I should switch to vodka. Because vodka doesn't smell like whiskey. And I don't care how much perfume or mints or whatever, you could smell alcohol on me. It just permeated out of my pores as much as I drank. So I went on to have grand mal seizures. I broke my jaw riding a bicycle at a 0.24. I endoed impact to the asphalt, my chin. I took about 10 stitches here, and I totally displaced and fractured my jaw. It went off to the side over here. You know, the seizures, I almost died. I had 3 grand mal seizures right in front of my mom. I went into Salvation Army twice. I did Teen Challenge. I don't know if any of you have ever heard of Teen Challenge. Obviously, I'm not a teenager, but it's a program for adults, and it's a whole year. They don't believe in AA. They don't believe in a 12-step program. It's all a faith-based program. So I went into Teen Challenge for a year. It did get me closer to my higher power. I will say that. I definitely needed that in my life. I was raised Catholic, so I believed in God my whole entire life, but I didn't understand what it was like to have a personal relationship with God or to have a conscious contact with God. And this is what you have taught me is about higher power. My self-will is so strong, and I didn't know what it was like to lean on God. And so programs didn't work for me. I would go into Teen Challenge. I went into Salvation Army. I had a choice when I got out of the programs if I wanted to go to AA. Salvation Army is an excellent program that is not only faith-based, but it's a 12-step program. You have to get a sponsor. They make you get a sponsor. They make you memorize your steps. They don't make you complete your steps or work your steps when you're in the program. It's a really hard program. They do Bible studies and other things, but they make you go to so many meetings, and they make you have sponsor meetings. As a matter of fact, I sponsor a woman in Salvation Army right now. And, you know, but it's your choice. When you get out of a program, I mean, really, what do you want? And I ultimately didn't, you know, after Salvation Army, I got rid of my sponsor. I stopped going to meetings. And I stayed sober for a year and a half between that program and then after getting out. But I was white knuckling it after that. You know, I had no relationship with God. My sponsor, I just stopped calling her. I didn't go to meetings. And ultimately, after a year and a half, you know, I started thinking, you know, maybe I'm not alcoholic. You know, I went a whole year and a half without drinking. And, you know, I'm thinking I'm doing pretty good, right? I'm making everybody else around me miserable. I'm living with my mom. And I don't have custody of my daughter. I had lost custody of my daughter long before that. My ex-husband had custody of her. And, you know, I only got to see her. Like, when I was in Teen Challenge, I got to see her all of, like, 3 times. When I was in Salvation Army, I got to see her a little bit more because the program was in Fresno. But, you know, I had no contact with her hardly at all. And, you know, my life was just an absolute mess. But yet, maybe I'm not alcoholic. So I decide, you know, I can have a drink. So the first night I got a little half pint, and I drank the whole half pint, and I stopped. I went like 3, I woke up the next morning, I didn't even have a hangover, you know, and I went about 3 days. I'm like, see, I'm an alcoholic, I can do this. So I went and bought a pint. So I drank the pint the next night, that third night or fourth night later, and drank the whole pint. And I'm telling you, alcoholically, okay, I didn't just mix it with a little bit of, you know, it was straight, and boom, the bottle was gone. Woke up the next morning, had a little bit of a hangover, but went another 3 or 4 days, and I'm like, see, I'm not alcoholic. I can drink every day, right? I can do this. Then it was the court. And then, long story short, second DUI. And I wound up, that got a little bit better. It was a .24. And, but again, and what they did is they grandfathered my first. It was like 8 years apart. And it used to be 7, but they made it 10 years, you know, if you had DUIs. And so they grandfathered my first one in. It became hard to suspend it. And, I finally got a phone number of this woman. I finally gave in. My sister said, hey, here's a phone number of a woman that my girlfriend knows. She is in AA and she sponsors people, and I really suggest that you call her. So I was like, okay, I'll try it. So I get on the phone and I call her, and this woman doesn't know me from Adam, right? She has no idea who I am. I tell her, I got your phone number from my sister who knows a friend of yours, and, you know, she said that you sponsor people. And she said, oh, okay, so she said you're alcoholic. And at that point, I was like, after 2 DUIs, you know, the metal plate inside of my head, not having custody of my daughter, not being able to hold jobs, you know, 0.34, 0.24, you know, it's like, I'm just a train wreck. And I said, yes, I'm an alcoholic and I need help. And she said, well, are you willing to go to any length? And I said, yes, I am. And I truly believed that I was at that point. And so, and I neglected to tell you that that second DUI was also an accident. I rear-ended a couple on Freeway 41 in Fresno at 65 miles an hour. and they were at a dead stop. And nobody was hurt. Nobody was hurt. I still truly believe that it was God and telling me, you're done, Michelle, this is it. I'm going to give you another chance. And those people walked away from that. They were in an SUV. As a matter of fact, their vehicle was hardly damaged. My car wasn't totaled, but it was pretty trashed. And it was still running. I don't know how that happened, but the car was still running. And so this woman taught me about commitment meetings. She said, what I do is I go to 2 commitment meetings a week. She said, I go to 1 on Tuesday, normally, you know, around the middle of the week or so. And then she said, I have a commitment meeting on the weekend. And one of them was a big book study. She said, and then I go to as many as I want or as many as I can the rest of the week. Now, mind you, she had a full-time job. She was married. She had a family. Her full-time job was she worked down in, she worked at a prison south of Fresno. I can't think of, maybe it was Corcoran. Anyway, so she had that commute. But this woman would get off work, come and pick me up from my job, and take me to a meeting 2 nights a week. We went on Tuesdays and Thursdays. And she would take me to the meeting, and then afterwards, if we wanted to have coffee or whatever, sometimes before we'd have something to eat, and she started taking me through my steps. Then she would drop me off at my house, and I lived north Fresno, just outside of Fresno off of 41 on the San Joaquin River, and then she lived way out on Ashland and 99. I don't know if you know Fresno very well, but that's a big, huge loop. And she didn't get home sometimes until 9:30, 10 o'clock at night. And she did that for me. She didn't know who I was. That woman never asked me for gas money. She never complained, never batted an eye. Lovingly, and I mean, I can be really ignorant sometimes. And the patience that she had with me was amazing. And, you know, she taught me basically what the program is all about. You know, I was taught about trust God, clean house, and help others. Steps 1, 2, and 3 is trusting in God. Steps 4 through 11 is cleaning house, and then 12 is helping others. And that's definitely what this woman was doing. That first year of my sobriety, you know, because I thought it was just about when I came in, I was just going to stop drinking. That was my problem. Drinking was my problem and nothing else. And so, you know, I thought I was going to be able to be like her someday. You know, I was going to have a real job. I was going to have my family back. You know, I was going to be able to have a nice car and do all the things that she does. She, like, you know, her and her husband could travel. And, you know, they were just very successful and seemed very happy. And so that's what I thought was going to happen with me. And little did I find out that alcohol was not my problem. Alcohol was my solution. And that the real tough road for me to haul was ahead of me yet. And so, you know, my first sponsor introduced me to my husband. My husband and I have been married almost a year, or a little over a year, but we've been together almost 10. And it was when I was heart suspended and I couldn't drive, period. So she said, hey, I know this guy in the program, and he lives out by you, and he has this Silver Bowl party every year. And she said, you know, what they do is, like, he barbecues a bunch of meat, and then everybody comes, and they bring something at the potluck, and then halftime, they go outside, and they play horseshoes, and they throw the football around, and it's just a bunch of clean, sober fun. And he does a Silver Bowl party every year. And she said, why don't you come with me, and I'll introduce you to him, and, you know, maybe he can, like, help you get into town every day to get to work. And so I went to the Sober Bowl party with him and or with her, and she introduced me to my husband. And so, nice guy. You know, nice guy. I was not attracted to him. I was not, you know, romantically or physically attracted to him when we met. Nor he said he wasn't to me, you know, me either, but I don't believe that. Anyway, so, because why would he say, yeah, I'll take her in town every day? But the truth of the matter is, trust God, he can help others. And so he, to him, it was being in service. And he was the complete gentleman, you know, for like 6 months. We just got to know each other. He picked me up every morning. You know, he talked about his sponsees. He talked about, you know, his road to recovery and what Alcoholics Anonymous had done for him. He was in and out of the rooms for like 10 years before he finally got it. And, you know, I struggled quite a bit between my two DUIs, kind of dabbling in the rooms a little bit and not serious about it. And so, you know, I learned a lot from him, and he was just a great example for the program. As a matter of fact, when we first kind of started romantically becoming attracted to each other, it scared me, and I thought, you know, I'm selfish. I'm so selfish. It's like, well, I'm not going to have enough time with you. And he started laughing. He's like, what? And I said, well, you talk about all these sponsees, you know, and you talk about all your meetings. And, you know, I don't know. You know, I was doing my two commitment meetings, but I still wasn't, like, fully into this, you know. And he said, what do you mean you're not going to have enough time? I go, I won't have enough time with you. You know, you are too busy in this program. And he said, Michelle, let me tell you something. He said, I used to do the same thing that you're doing right now. You feel like you're clingy to, you know, the significant other. You don't think you're going to have enough time with me, so you enmesh or whatever. He said, let me tell you. He said, the most important thing is that you trust in God and you give your all to this program. Get into service. And you put God in this program first, I can guarantee you we will have enough time together. And I thought, okay, what the heck? You know, why not? And sure enough, you know, I mean, 10 years later almost, we're still together. And it's been the healthiest relationship that I have ever had in my life. 20 years with my ex-husband, 10 not being married, 10 married, and it was just horrific. I mean, there were some good times, but the majority of it was just unhealthy, total, like, train wreck of a relationship. And so I learned a lot about prayer and meditation. He taught me about prayer and meditation, page 788 of the big book, this format that is just really amazing, where I pray in every morning, and then I incorporate, or I've learned to incorporate, the third and the seventh step prayer. And then I read out of 24 hours a day. I have reflections. So I have like three meditation books that I read out of. And then I pray out. So it's about, you know, 15, 20 minutes longer if I can on the weekends. And prayer meditation is so important for me. I joke about it, and I don't want to be disrespectful to anybody who's Catholic, but I joke that I'm a recovering Catholic, because I thank God for being raised Catholic, because that's where I got my foundation and my belief in God. But again, I wasn't taught about a personal relationship. And it's so important for me to know that I have this higher power. See, when I was raised, I thought that I had a punishing God. I thought that if I was bad, I was going to be punished. I thought that if I did anything wrong, that God was going to punish me. And so I prayed at meals, prayed at night before I went to bed, and that was really about it. And what this program has taught me is that I could have a God of my own understanding. And so this God that I have today is just amazing. He's caring, he's forgiving, he's loving, he's non-judgmental. I mean, he loves all of us exactly the same. There is no difference between any one of us to him. I know how much he loves me. And I mean, my hard thing was not ever seeing him, feeling him, hearing him. It was just really hard for me to grasp that God concept. And today, I can just feel him. You know, I feel his presence. Like, I feel his presence here right now. It's just been amazing, this relationship that I've been taught about God. So when that first year of my sobriety and meeting my husband and my first sponsor, and I realized that alcohol was not, you know, my problem, it was like almost immediately I was told, get down on your knees every morning and ask God to remove that drinking obsession. I can guarantee you that God will remove it. Ask him every day. And I still do this. Almost 10 years later, I still ask God every day to keep removing this obsession from me. And it's amazing how it works. It really is. But what I learned from my first sponsor was she started getting into emotional sobriety. I was in theater for like 7 years when I was in junior high and high school, so Miss Drama Queen. And so I didn't know what it was like to have emotional sobriety. I didn't know that, you know, what's really ahead of me now is how to live life on life's terms. And so that first year of my sobriety, there was a conference in Grass Valley. I don't know if any of you ever heard of Wayne Butler, but he gives an emotional sobriety conference. And it's amazing. His conference is absolutely amazing about, you know, how to live life on life's terms and emotional sobriety. And that whole weekend, we laughed, we cried. My cheeks hurt every single day, night. We sat in his, you know, classes. And, you know, I learned so much about, you know, it is not just about not drinking. I mean, of course, Alcoholics Anonymous is about not drinking, but it's also so importantly about an emotional sobriety and how to live life on life's terms. I had, you know, no relationship, couldn't hold jobs. My daughter, she was like afraid of me towards the end. She was 4 and a half when I left her dad. My drinking spiraled after that. From the time she was 6 until she was 13, I was in and out of programs. I was there and not, there and not. My family, my ex-husband, wouldn't trust me to even drive with her. And today, she lives on her own. She wants me to spend the night with her. We go to dinner like once a week. She calls me. She calls me for advice. And it just amazes me because, you know, I thought I had lost my daughter forever. You know, I couldn't imagine myself never drinking again. I slept with my bottle. I had a bottle under the front seat of my car. I had a bottle in my purse. I had a bottle, the gallon in the trunk of my car. And, you know, when I switched from whiskey to vodka, I would put the vodka in a water bottle, and I could have the water bottle in the center console of my car. I drove around constantly drinking. I would wake up in the middle of the night shaking, and I just knew I was going to have seizures again. So I would reach under the bed, and I would pull out my bottle. And, you know, it was just total dysfunction and total insanity. I had no hope at all. There were times when I was curled up in a fetal position in my bed, and I didn't want to get out of bed, let alone step a foot out of the house. And I felt like I was worthless. There was just, I mean, absolutely no hope for me at all. And so since I've had three sponsors now, and my third sponsor, she's amazing, and what she does is pulls no punches with me at all. And she's like my first sponsor in the sense where she never stops, like, learning in this program. She never stops growing. You know, she's just amazing. I don't call her enough. I will be honest. I don't call her enough, especially lately. I've been letting my job overconsume me. And, you know, my husband gets worried about that because, you know, when it's not about drinking. I'm not afraid I'm going to drink, but it's my emotional sobriety. You know, I'll become that dry drunk, I'll make him miserable, and I will, you know, probably say something to my daughter to hurt her. I'll probably say something to my coworker that, you know, is not appropriate. Might lose my temper. You know, I don't want to be like that. For me today, it's that emotional sobriety. And being able to handle situations which used to baffle me. You know, I want to continue being able to do that. Right now, I've been in the job that I have right now. I've been on this job for 4.5 years. I was able to start out as a temp, and they kept me for 2 years. While I was working there as a temp for 2 years, I was going to school. I graduated from high school back in 1982 and never went to college. So about 5 years ago, I decided, you know what? I think I want to go to school. I worked for a small credit union. I saw credit unions closing. I saw them merging with larger financial institutions and people losing their jobs. And so I was getting in a lot of fear. So I thought, well, you know, I need to probably get another, you know, like, trade behind me, another profession. So, like, you know, 48 years old and I'm going to college. I went to school for 2 years. I did a trade school, so it was escalated. And I went to school for 2 years. I had a minimum of a 3.5 GPA the whole time I was in school. I had a 99% attendance rate. Me, 99% attendance rate. And the only three times that I missed was my husband's mom passed away, my brother passed away, and my daughter's graduation. And that was it. I graduated with honors. I made the president's list twice, the director's list three times. This alcoholic does not do stuff like that. There's no way. And I obtained an associate's degree in paralegal. I work for a mortgage company today. I haven't been able to use my degree. I don't know if I'm going to. This job where I'm at, after I worked there for 2 years as a temp, I decided I was going to try to become, you know, a paralegal, get a job for an attorney, and I just really didn't like this man that I worked for, and it wasn't working out for me. Well, he ended up letting me go, which really was the best thing that ever happened. I went to work for another mortgage company, and that one wasn't going to work out. I wasn't happy there. And my old boss called me, and he said, "Hey, Michelle," he said, "what are you doing?" I was like, "Oh, you know, I'm in between jobs right now. You know, I'm not working." He goes, "You're kidding me." He goes, "I got corporate to be able to hire you full-time permanent." And I was like, "You've got to be kidding me." So, I mean, he called me back to work there. You know, that's not me. That's not Michelle the alcoholic. So I've been able to maintain a job for over 4 years now. I was able to obtain an associate's degree in paralegal. I have amazing relationships today. My husband, my daughter, my boss tells me I'm weird. This is going to sound funny to you, but my husband and I don't live together. My mom is, she's almost 8 years old, and that woman never gave up on me. Never gave up on me. She lives in a mobile home where she financially can't afford to live there. She has her space rent. She has a mortgage on the mobile home. and she had lost her job. She was like a year and a half shy of a full pension, and they fired her. So she has like a baby pension and a social security, and she financially can't make it there on her own. So my husband tells me, after we lost his mom real sudden-like, who his mom never gave up on him ever through, you know, his whole journey. And he said, Michelle, life is too short. And your mom has always been there for you. She never gave up on you. I'd like, you know, if you want, he says, I'm not going anywhere. He said, you stay with your mom. You help take care of her. You help make her life much more comfortable and easier for the rest of her life, and you enjoy her. You know, embrace your mom and stay with her and help take care of her. And I'm like, are you real? I mean, seriously? And so it's just amazing the things that happen in my life. Absolutely amazing today. You know, it's never perfect. I was telling my husband about it tonight. I work with a lady who's got a very, very strong personality. Very strong personality. And she ended up getting angry with me the other day. And, you know, for me, it's like the way I used to be is I never used to do anything wrong. You know, it was always somebody else doing something to me. You know, if I was the victim, you know, you were the one that was always the bad person. You were always the one that did something wrong, and it wasn't me. It was never me. And so, but I had a way to pray about it. She wouldn't even talk to me for a whole day. And, you know, I thought, well, you know, I think I do owe her an amends for what she thinks that I did. So I did. I went up to her and I said, you know, I owe you an amends for, you know, I think I handled that wrong. I really do. I think I handled it wrong. And, you know, she's like hugging me. She hugged me this morning when she got to work. You know, it's like I don't have to hang on to that stuff anymore. You know, I don't have to, like, lose relationships anymore. I mean, if she wouldn't have accepted that amends, then, you know, that's a given. There's nothing I can do about it. But had I not approached her like that and made an amends, we probably would have, you know, remained like that. And, you know, who wants a working relationship with somebody like that? So because of this program, because of Alcoholics Anonymous, because of all of you, you know, in these rooms, I owe my whole life today to Alcoholics Anonymous. I was that hopeless, helpless, dying. I was dying, you know, inside. I was, my body, everything about me was just a wreck. And I could never imagine myself not drinking again. And today, I can't imagine myself ever drinking again. So, I want to thank Rick for, and Kirk for suggesting, you know, that whenever I'm asked to do something in Alcoholics Anonymous, I don't ever want to say no. I don't, because, you know, this disease is cunning, baffling, and powerful. I have to be really protective over my sobriety. And the way that only way that I know how to do that is what you've shown me, is to have my commitment meetings, to be in service, to call my sponsor more, and, you know, just to always stay in the moment, stay in today, and know that, you know, I have this amazing higher power and you people in this program that are just a wonderful support. So thank you so much for being here. And my name is Michelle. I'm an alcoholic. Thank you.